Let's start with Robert Frost's famous poem about Mormon history. I'm sure you all remember it. I shall be telling this with a sigh, somewhere ages and ages hence. Two roads diverged in the Mormon history wood, and I took both of them just for kicks. And that has made all the difference in this episode. Obviously, Frost was talking about different approaches to the Book of Mormon. Anyone can see that. A few episodes back, we talked about the history of the translation and publication of the Book of Mormon. Great episode. And we mentioned how we would talk more about the translation part. Well, that day has come.
Hi, this is Lindsay Hanson Park.
And this is Brian Buchanan.
Bringing you the story of Mormonism from the shadow of the everlasting hills, straight out of Zion. This isn't your grandpa's Mormon history.
I've sinned so gravely, Brother Brigham, Brother Young. I have sinned so gravely, Brother Young.
This is the tale of Mormon saints and sinners, from our roots until present day. Saddle up.
Gird your loins, lock your hearts, and pay your tithing, because we're bringing you the story of Mormonism in all its paradisiacal glory.
It's the Sunstone History Podcast.
Well, I've sinned so gravely, Brother Brigham, Brother Young. I've sinned so gravely, Brother Young. That only you can save me, Brother Brigham, Brother Young. But only you can save me, Brother Young.
So the first road Mr. Frost spoke of has a sign reading, Believing Approach. So in Rough Brush Stokes, it is, Joseph Smith is visited by an angel. He's part of an ancient society in the Americas that recorded their history on metal plates. Joseph Smith acquires these plates, along with some other stuff, including an ancient set of Urim and Thummim and the Sword of Laban, which I own, and you can't see it. He translates the text on the plates into English, producing a manuscript. The manuscript is published as the Book of Mormon. There you go. Now, this road is by no means a monolithic road. Far from it. There are books, there are articles, there are conferences, there are tours, and yeah, there's lots of things. So back in that episode, you heard one perspective from Brian Hales on the believing approach.
Okay, let's explore just one aspect of this a little bit, because this is a huge thing. This is something people debate about. I mean, there's a whole, like, Book of Mormon project nonprofit where people talk about this stuff. I mean, scholars at BYU have been working on this forever. There's whole industries, travel industries related to this book. There's a lot going on. I want to talk about translation. What does it mean? Some see it very much in the contemporary sense of translation. Joseph Smith is enabled via Urim and Thummim, which equals a seer stone, maybe, to understand the text and produces an English text that reflects the original. BYU professor Royal Skousen, who is sort of like the OG contemporary voice on this, has argued for quote, tight control of the text, meaning that Joseph Smith sees, in some way, including how names are spelled and works with a specific amount of words at a time. There are many other ideas, including the Book of Mormon is an expansion of an authentic ancient text, but also reflects the 19th century culture in which it was translated. In recent years, the use of a seer stone, likely the one Joseph Smith basically swiped from Willard Chase, has become more mainstream. And this was obvious in 2015 when the LDS Church published photos of the seer stone, which had previously been in deep, deep storage. Like, if you were to bring up seer stones, people would be like, stop being weird, that's priestcraft. Go practice on your Ouija boards. But then all of a sudden, 2015 comes and seer stones are cool again. 2015, it's the 2000s. Seer stones are back. Artwork depicting Joseph Smith and the seer stone in a hat is now becoming more common. Fun side note, at Sunstone Symposium every year in the summer, we have Terrell Musser, who is a descendant of Joseph Musser, the great-grandfather of Mormon fundamentalism. And Terrell is a stonemason, and he gets stones from all over the world and sells them as seer stones at Sunstone.
All right, Mr. Frost, your other road. So the sign here reads, Other Approaches. So let's return to that statement from Terrell Givens at the start of the episode before we go down this road. In the fantastic 2007 PBS documentary, The Mormons, they interviewed Terrell, and he noted, quote, the kind of revelation that Joseph describes is the scandal of Mormonism, in the same way that the resurrection of Christ is the scandal of Christianity. What I mean by that is that on the face of it, that's an affront to sophisticated notions of how the universe works. God doesn't deliver gold plates to farm boys. It's a cause of embarrassment to many intellectuals in the church to continue to insist that Joseph had literal gold plates given to him by a real angel. But I also mean that it's a scandal in the sense that it is inseparable from the heart and soul of Mormonism. That one could no sooner divorce the historical claims of the Book of Mormon from the church than one could divorce the story of Christ's resurrection from Christianity and survive with the religion intact. Close quote. So in the first letter to the Corinthians, Paul talks about the crucifixion of Jesus being a, quote, stumbling block. And the Greek word behind it, scandalon, is where we get scandal in English. In other words, something that doesn't quite seem to make sense. From the time the Book of Mormon was first talked about, various counter theories were developed to explain the book's existence. Well, let's cover a few of them.
The first theory that seems to have been proposed, and this was in 1831, was that Sidney Rigdon was the actual author. The underlying theme for this and many other theories was that the Book of Mormon was a product of someone in 1830, not anciently, but that Joseph Smith wasn't smart enough to have ever done it. And of course, Brian Hales talks about this a few episodes ago, where he talks about the work he's doing to talk about how the Book of Mormon came to be. Over the next couple years, a similar theory was proposed. This one, at least in the 19th century, had the most legs. In this theory, a preacher named Solomon Spaulding wrote a novel, and this was about 1812, about a colony of Romans that ended up in the Western Hemisphere. In the introduction, Spaulding is inspired by finding ruins of an ancient fort. The claim that Spaulding's manuscript was the basis for the Book of Mormon was then included in the 1834 book, Mormonism Unveiled, which I feel like there's been a few iterations of that. Over the next few years, it was then claimed that Rigdon either knew Spaulding or had acquired the manuscript and then, either in cahoots with Joseph Smith or more by himself, created the Book of Mormon. However, in the 1880s, a manuscript written by Spaulding was discovered and was then available to review. By now, pretty much everyone agrees that this theory doesn't hold water.
After the discovery of the Spaulding manuscript, the next major theory comes from a psychologist. Isaac Woodbridge Riley wrote a master's thesis at Yale that explored Joseph Smith and the Book of Mormon on psychological grounds. And then his research was later expanded into a book called The Founder of Mormonism, published in 1902. As he noted in the preface, quote, "Sectarians and phrenologists, spiritualists and mesmerists have variously interpreted Joseph Smith's more or less abnormal performances, and now remains for the psychologists to have a try at them," close quote. So Riley saw epilepsy and hallucinations in Joseph Smith's ancestors, like Lucy Mack's father, Solomon, for example. And then he argued that Lucy Mack was a combination of, quote, partial illiteracy and entire credulity, close quote. And then he said this resulted in Joseph Smith having epileptic seizures and dictating the Book of Mormon in episodes of automatic writing.
Ironically, the next major theory was developed by an LDS leader. One of my favorites, B.H. Roberts, a general authority in the LDS Church First Council 70 since 1880, owned a first edition of the Book of Mormon, which he marked heavily, noting odd things, contradictions, etc. He dealt with issues like this with statements such as these, quote, "The translator is responsible for the verbal and grammatical errors in the translating. Also, to talk of literal translation is to talk of literal nonsense." And, quote, "The translation of the Book of Mormon is English in idiom and the idiom of time and locality where it was produced," end quote. So you can see B.H. Roberts is sort of struggling with this. And in the 1920s, Roberts was forced to really tackle these questions. It began, like every good Mormon story, with a letter from a guy named Bill in Salina, Utah.
Here's the setup. There is an experiment station down there, apparently studying the effects of poisonous plants. A young LDS guy working there, William Ryder, is working with a non-Mormon from Washington, D.C. Likely it's a chemist named James F. Couch. And they're talking about things, you know, obviously the questions about Mormonism come up, and Couch becomes curious about the Book of Mormon and the claims that stand behind it. So he asks his Mormon friend questions that he couldn't handle. Ryder's solution? Write to Apostle James E. Talmadge. That guy knows everything. Talmadge, interestingly, passes the buck, sends it on to B.H. Roberts. So here are Couch's questions. Number one, how could the great diversity in primitive Indian languages have occurred in such a short period after about AD 400, when the Nephites, whose Hebrew language was so highly developed, disappeared? Number two, the Book of Mormon reports that the followers of Lehi, upon their arrival in the New World, found horses which were not in existence when the first Spanish explorers arrived. Three, Although the Jews had no knowledge of steel in 600 BC, Nephi was reported to have had a bow of steel after he left Jerusalem. 4. The Book of Mormon speaks of swords and scimitars, yet the word scimitar does not appear in early literature before the rise of Mohammedanism, Islam, which took place after Lehi departed from Jerusalem. 5. Even though silk was not known in America, the Nephites knew of and used silk.
Very interesting. Couch clearly was very familiar with the Book of Mormon to be asking questions like this. Robert sets out to answer them, apparently thinking it would be a breeze, but it wasn't. After several weeks, Ryder leaves his work on fire-breathing Venus flytraps or whatever he was doing in Salina and writes to Roberts asking, "Where are my answers, Mr. Sir?" Roberts asks for an extension and then writes to Church President Heber J. Grant saying that, quote, "He found the difficulties more serious than I had thought." Roberts had a manuscript, 141 pages, and he wants to present it to absolutely everyone. And First Presidency Quorum of the 12 Apostles and his colleagues in the First Council of the 70. And he wants to present it to everyone. The First Presidency Quorum of the 12 Apostles and his colleagues in the First Council of the 70. Really excited. Grant says, fine, let's do it.
It takes Roberts 2 full days to present his findings. Talmadge, who's at this point probably feeling relieved he had passed the buck on to him, noted in his journal that the report was valuable. And then he said this, quote, "I know the Book of Mormon to be a true record. And many of the objections, as opposing critics would urge, are after all but difficulties, or negative in their nature. The Book of Mormon states that Lehi and his colony found horses upon this continent when they arrived, and therefore, horses were here at that time," close quote. Probably a good thing that Talmadge didn't do the report. So they have these two-day meetings, they're not satisfactory to Roberts, and so he kind of pursues it on his own. Then, he's called as president of the Eastern States Mission, which just so happens to cover most of these key early Mormon sites. His time as mission president is fascinating. On one hand, he's encouraging his missionaries to convert people to Mormonism, using the Book of Mormon, telling them in a letter, quote, "It has survived all the ridicule and mockery of those who have scorned it. Its voice is testimony of the Christ as eternal God," close quote. On the other hand, he's really diving back into this question of its creation. You can tell it bugged him and he wouldn't let it go. So Roberts is doing some reading that was not exactly the approved missionary library. Of particular interest is a book called View of the Hebrews, which we've talked about a couple times before.
In 1823, Protestant minister Ethan Smith, no relation to Joseph, published the first edition of View of the Hebrews, exhibiting the destruction of Jerusalem, the certain restoration of Judah and Israel, the present state of Judah and Israel, and an address of the prophet Isaiah relative to the restoration, end quote. Mouthful. It was a short book, unlike its title. Just under 200 pages. 2 years later, he published an expanded second edition. The book seems to have been popular, and there may have been some broad connections between Ethan Smith and Joseph Smith. Ethan visited Palmyra, and some of Oliver Cowdery's family were members of the congregation that Ethan Smith presided over, but not, apparently, at the same time. Could Joseph Smith have been aware of the book? Certainly. Was it the inspiration of the Book of Mormon? That is a far more complicated question. The idea of Joseph Smith sitting down with it and then composing the Book of Mormon seems a little too unlikely. Could the general framework have been part of the creation of the Book of Mormon? Again, a possibility. It is interesting that early Mormons brought up View of the Hebrews as something that supported Mormonism. In subsequent years, various other books have been suggested as being possible sources for the content of the Book of Mormon, such as The Golden Pot and The Late War. We're going to bring on a few other scholars to weigh in what they think and how they think the creation of this book came to be.
Hi, my name is Sheldon Kent, and I am a sociologist of religion, currently completing a PhD in religious studies at Lancaster University, England. So, what I am currently working on right now is a theory that seeks to describe Joseph Smith as what I call an occultural bricoleur. Now, bricoleurge, where I get the word bricoleur from, is a French term that I have borrowed from Claude Levi Strauss, who originally used the term as a metaphor to explain the ways in which mythological thought creates meaning and fixes myths by replacing missing or forgotten elements with residual components. In short, bricolage simply translates into something along the lines of do-it-yourself. So a bricoleur is someone who constructs something himself or herself. In this instance, I'm using the term in relation to the construction of a new religion, though I do think it is worth pointing out here that the bricoleur is not simply free to create something from nothing, but is instead limited by the influence of social, cultural, environmental, and psychological factors. The theory of a culture, on the other hand, refers to the environment within which, and the social processes by which, particular meanings relating typically to spiritual, esoteric, occult, paranormal, and even conspiratorial ideas emerge, are disseminated, and become influential in societies and in the lives of individuals. It describes certain shared attitudes, values, and practices that characterize society. A culture is never absent. It is, historically, a feature of all societies, and a culture is used to mean both a whole way of life and the special processes of discovery and creative effort. A culture then seeks to account for a broadly spiritual environment, an ambient environment, which provides a range of ideas that go on to influence people. It is not necessarily therefore a culture of the occult, although it does of course include that, but it is instead a culture of rejected metaphysical and paranormal discourses. In Joseph Smith's day, there were a range of these ideas circulated by mouth, in urban legends, in newspapers, and so on. The occultural bricoleur basically constructs a belief system around what interests and makes sense of his or her experience of the world. There is no orthodoxy as such until, of course, one is established as the construct begins to become fixed by the bricoleur as revelation, and then by followers who feel they need to protect it as sacred and to make sense of it as an authoritative religious tradition. Therefore, it is to be expected that people who are active in religious bricolage should be high in creativity. Either they create new responses, ideas, or rituals, or they proceed to a new structuring of pre-existing religious elements. The transmission of occultural ideas in North America took place primarily through the printing and selling of books, with a commercial book trade being established when the first settlers arrived. Thousands of esoteric works entered into circulation, though it was predominantly books printed in and imported from Europe that were read by early Americans. Towards the end of the 17th century, however, cunning folk both owned and were practicing out of books on astrology, magic, occult philosophy, and palmistry. Yet while it was relatively easy to control what the general populace were reading in the early days of European colonialism, it was almost impossible to control once the colonies were more established, and even more so after the American Revolutionary War. There is evidence to suggest that during and after the war, the spread of esoteric ideas significantly increased by a variety of new contacts from Europe. French troops working with the Americans and Hessian troops serving with the British added to the possible channels for these ideas to spread, for example. The arrival of a number of new and esoteric religions such as the Swedenborgians also greatly aided in the spread of esoteric ideas when they brought with them various publications from Europe, and it was the cities of the eastern half of the country that would become the generators of numerous occult organisations and magical publications with far-reaching consequences. So, in relation to this podcast, as an occultural bricoleur, Joseph Smith borrowed from his local environment not just ideas from 19th century American culture, but also from the general social and religious climate to construct the Book of Mormon.
Hi, this is Christopher Smith again with some thoughts about the debate over the Book of Mormon. The debate over the Book of Mormon really heated up after 1979, when a group of Mormon scholars founded what's called the Foundation for Ancient Research and Mormon Studies, FARMS, or FARMS for short. FARMS published a couple of journals, the FARMS Review of Books and the Journal of Book of Mormon Studies, both of which were dedicated to the scholarly defense of the Church and the Book of Mormon. FARMS became a formal part of BYU in 1997 under the auspices of the Neil A. Maxwell Institute. And as part of BYU, FARMS was both kind of a point of pride for the Church and a point of embarrassment for it. There were a lot of people who felt like FARMS was doing really important work and it was winning the war against the Church's critic, but FARMS could also be really acerbic, and it published a lot of personal attacks against the Church's critics. For example, in one famous episode, a scholar named Bill Hamblin published an article critiquing a book by a historian named Brent Metcalf, and Hamblin arranged his article as an acrostic so that the first letters of each line in the article spelled out the phrase Metcalf is butthead, and that became sort of an infamous thing. FARMS never lived it down. Became sort of a symbol of just how mean FARMS could be sometimes. And the acid tone of the farm's publications led to a lot of internal conflict at the Neil A. Maxwell Institute. And eventually the leaders of farms were sort of kicked out of the institute, and farms was disbanded by BYU. But the old leaders of farms have started a new journal called the Mormon Interpreter, through which even today they continue this war against the church's critics. But they no longer do it under the auspices of BYU, and I don't think the new journal has anything like the following that the old one did, so the heyday of this Book of Mormon debate is really kind of over at this point. But back in the heyday of farms, they responded to basically two types of critics. The first type was the evangelical Christians. And early on, this is where most of the criticism was coming from, particularly some groups like the Utah Lighthouse Ministry, run by Gerald and Sandra Tanner, and the Mormonism Research Ministry, run by Bill McKeever and others, Eric Johnson. And these kinds of critics are where farms initially spent most of its energy. And answering the Christians was really where farms excelled, because the Christians took issue with Mormon doctrines like the idea that you can receive revelation, or that you can have scriptures outside of the Bible, or that you can become a god after you die, or you can be baptized in the place of a dead person, etc., etc. And on all these points, the Mormons had like a surprising amount of evidence on their side, both from biblical scholars and from early church fathers who wrote within a few hundred years of Jesus's life. So these are sort of extra biblical writings, but they're very early. And so they give us some idea of what early Christians believed. And it turns out early Christians believed that people would be deified when they died. Maybe they hadn't spelled out so much about getting your own planet and populating it with spirit children and that kind of thing, but the core idea that you'd become a god after you die was there in early Christianity. And so Mormon scholars could point to these things and, you know, make a fairly persuasive case. And when Christians pointed out Book of Mormon contradictions or false prophecies or anachronisms in the Book of Mormon, the farms people could just point right back at the Bible and say, the Bible has contradictions and false prophecies and anachronisms too, and you still believe in the Bible, so what are you coming after us for? And there wasn't a lot that the evangelicals could say to that sort of argument. And so farms did pretty well against the Christians. The other type of critic was the professional scholars. And over the years, farms had to devote more and more of its energy to attacking these kinds of people, professional scholars like historians or theologians who took issue with the Book of Mormon and its historicity, or with Joseph Smith and his life. And this could be a little bit like cannibalistic, because a lot of the people that they went after were Mormons. These were members of the LDS Church, faithful members in some cases, who just weren't orthodox enough for farms. And farms could be kind of vicious sometimes. They'd go on personal attack, and that's really where they got in trouble, and that's what kind of ended their institute. But leaving aside the personal attacks, let's look at a couple of the substantive issues that they discussed during the heyday of this debate. So one of the professional scholar types who criticized the Book of Mormon was David P. Wright. And Wright was a Mormon scholar. He was a member of the church who was trained as a scholar of the Bible. And he published an essay on the Book of Mormon's use of Isaiah. And the Book of Mormon includes long sections of the biblical book of Isaiah, with whole chapters quoted almost verbatim from the King James Version of the Bible. And Nephi is supposed to have copied from plates of brass that contained a bunch of the Old Testament writings onto the golden plates. And so he is transferring the writings of Isaiah from these brass plates to the golden plates. And there are a couple of problems with this that Wright pointed out. First of all, biblical scholars divide the book of Isaiah into two sections. There's chapters 1 through 39 called First Isaiah, which was actually written in the time of Isaiah. And then there's chapters 40 to 54, which were added 200 years later by a different author. And there are pretty persuasive arguments that Second Isaiah has to have been written later. And the problem is the Book of Mormon contains chapters from that second portion of Isaiah, which hadn't even been written yet at the time that Nephi is supposed to have lived. So this is what's called an anachronism. It's something that's out of time, right? It appears in a text that is supposed to be too early for it to have appeared in. And so there's just no way that these Isaiah chapters should be able to appear in the Book of Mormon. And Wright also pointed out a second problem, which in some ways is an even bigger problem, which is that the Isaiah chapters in the Book of Mormon are copied straight out of the King James Version of the Bible, including translation errors that appear in the King James Version. So this is not an independent translation of the writings of Isaiah that Joseph Smith is making. He's copying out of the King James Version, and he's even transferring over these translation errors. And the believer's response to Wright comes from a few different directions. First of all, they excommunicated him in 1993, so there's that. Secondly, they say either the biblical scholars are wrong about these later chapters of Isaiah. They appear in the Book of Mormon, so maybe the biblical scholars are just wrong. Or, alternatively, maybe God miraculously revealed to Nephi chapters of Isaiah that hadn't been written yet. So God reveals these chapters to Nephi 200 years before they're written. And as for the translation errors, they suggest that maybe God uses the King James Version because it's familiar to us, and he didn't bother to correct these translation errors because they weren't a big deal. And so these are, you know, not super persuasive responses, but they could be true. They're somewhat plausible. So the farms people had responses, but there were some trenchant criticisms that they struggled to deal with. But they didn't settle for just offering kind of half-baked responses to the critics. They also went on the attack. They proactively developed some very formidable arguments of their own for the historicity of the Book of Mormon. They do things like look at Arabia and Nephi's narrative of traveling through Arabia, and they find not only that the geography appears to match up fairly well with the Book of Mormon narrative, but even place names appear to be accurate place names that are found in Arabia. They look at Mesoamerica and try to show that Mesoamerican geography is consistent with what's described in the Book of Mormon, and that it's a plausible setting for the Book of Mormon. They look at ancient Hebrew names that appear in the Book of Mormon, don't appear in the Bible, and they find them in other texts, and they show that almost all the names in the Book of Mormon are credible Hebrew names, ancient Hebrew names. They look at ancient Middle Eastern texts, and they find parallels to Book of Mormon passages. They find what appear to be Hebrew poetic structures in the Book of Mormon. One is called chiasmus. You can look that up if you're interested in that. And in one of their most impressive efforts, they developed a computerized methodology called word printing that's supposed to be able to look at words like and the sort of irrelevant little articles and conjunctions and use of punctuation in a text. And the argument is basically that each author has, like everybody has an individual fingerprint. So similarly, everybody has an individual word print, just sort of patterns of language that they fall into habitually. And so if you compare two texts and you look at the use of language in the two texts, you should be able to statistically determine whether they're written by the same author or a different author. And the authors of this study looked at the Book of Mormon and found that Nephi had a different author than Alma. The use of language was so different in Nephi and Alma that they had to have been written by different authors. And so, okay, methodology isn't perfect, but, you know, I've dabbled in it a little bit myself, and I can confirm that the use of language in Alma does look a little bit different from the rest of the Book of Mormon, so I can see where they're coming from. And this is a debate that's actually still ongoing and still developing the methodology, refining it. The results are still somewhat promising for this attempt to, you know, show different authorship within the Book of Mormon. So I guess my point in all of this is, if you want to believe in the Book of Mormon, you can make a rational case for that. There's a lot of really smart people who believe that they have strong historical, archaeological, and statistical reasons for thinking that the Book of Mormon is an ancient text. And if you don't want to believe in the Book of Mormon, you can make a really strong case for that too. And I mean, I'm not going to say that the two sides are equivalent, because obviously I have my own opinions about which are the stronger arguments and who's right. But there are smart and thoughtful people on both sides of this debate, and despite the occasional sniping and meanness and personal attacks, I think everybody in the debate sincerely believes that they're right.
All right, eager readers, Books of Mormon report for today. Our book today is entitled New Approaches to the Book of Mormon, Explorations in Critical Methodology. And this was edited by our common friend, Brent Metcalf. And Brent, in addition to being perhaps the strongest guy in Mormon studies, is a pretty awesome guy. And this is a great book because it was the first time that the Book of Mormon was taken on, not from an antagonistic point of view, but from a critical point of view. So, scholarly level of research looking into different elements of the Book of Mormon. How does the King James Bible fit in? The italics there, Isaiah, all these different questions that people have had were taken on by various people like Brent, Dan Vogel, Mark Thomas, that really dug in, and it's a great book. So like all of our other books, you're very welcome to come down to Benchmark Books where we've got that, and we can show you that, other things we've talked about, and take you down some more rabbit holes.
As an offering for my sins, a smoking incense, Brother Young, a blood atoning for my sinning, Brother Young. 'Cause I sinned so gravely, Brother Brigham, Brother Young. I have sinned so gravely, Brother Young. That only you can save me, Brother Brigham, Brother Young.
The song you heard today is called Brother Brigham, Brother Young by an artist, Corb Lund. Check out his music at corblund.com. And consider giving a donation to sunstone.org to support this podcast.